He had been running a classification evidence analysis. The guy was something like
not, maybe not Bradwell.
I believe he was a USAID employee. They put in this job. He reported to George Jacobson.
Okay.
Jacobson was the assassin.
Yes.
So we backstopped a lot of the things at the country team meeting.
Okay.
And we were in the process of turning these systems over to the Vietnamese. And we were backstopping the systems to negotiate. I did all that as a cover.
Okay.
So I worked 50-60 hours a week to maintain a cover.
What, in the meantime, doing all the things that you had always done?
Yeah.
Only now talking to Polgar, or to somebody, to Polgar. And no longer George, but now somebody else.
Somebody else. They brought in some idiot who was an Eastern European specialist and was a really crack guy in Bulgaria and Czechoslovakia. And we didn't know what the fuck he was doing, but, you know, doing the shit and taking it back to the station.
Tell me his name if you remember.
But I was so disgusted with everything by then, I didn't care who the hell it was. I went through 3 or 4 people, you know, in the space of those 2 years or a year and a half as they rotated agency people home, kept assigning new people to me to make sure the paper flow continued until I reached the point where I discovered that, you know, they were doing that for their own purposes, not what I thought they should be doing for.
Well, I can tell. I mean, there. It's not just a weariness of
but you
having talked
for a
couple
of hours.
My
story in this, I assume.
Oh, yeah.
I bet you want to tell the story of Phoenix.
Yeah, I do, and if there's something that's been left out about the story of Phoenix, please, you know, now's the time. Have I overlooked some essential question not asked?
That's what I'm thinking about. What's maybe important about Phoenix that we didn't say in the course of this? Yeah, Phoenix did a number of other things. He worked with the Department of Interior on, you know, the administrative, judicial aspects. That's what Gage McAfee did a lot of. Of the laws, you know, of the status of people who were arrested,
mm-hmm.
and being able to incarcerate them indefinitely and having periodic reviews. I went down to the prison in Ponce Island a number of times, wandered around the cell blocks and talked to the D.C. prisoners. You know, we did a lot of that kind of judicial stuff, the other side of things, you know, about so what did you do when you got them?
Mm-hmm.
And were you going to let them say they were two boys after they were arrested or not?
No.
And how would you know whether they're two boys or they didn't if you'd arrested them? And, you know, I was one of the people who wrote a lot about how once we sent them to the prison, if they weren't DC before they got there, they damn sure when they came out, and that this was the greatest training center we had ever created.
Ho Chi Minh University.
And we kept the hardcore VCI down there, and then put these guys that we weren't really sure if they were VCI or not, but somehow or another we had arrested them. We sent them down there to get indoctrinated and trained, and they came back, you know, and then they were released into society because they had been low-level tax collectors or whatever, and by then they were a big political cadre in the D.C.
With status because they had been in consign.
You know, and they had trained them and recruited them and everything else while they were there and really had trained, got them to be big wheels, and then they were released as big wheels, but they were just peons when we made them into somebody.
Yeah.
You know, there were a lot of perverse effects.
That's an aspect that I'm going to deal with certainly, and it's a... The whole detainee problem is a theme which, to a great extent...
It's a very serious problem here.
It emerges from PICs, in a sense, because it's the status of the people who are put in the PIC that becomes very much
the problem.
We talk
about the interrogation, but, you know, what you do with them afterwards is a real problem.
One guy put it to me this way. He said nobody wanted to be the jailer of Vietnam. And so that for many, many years, people kept... giving the problem to, you know, that everybody kept giving the problem to the military.
Send them off to Khon San, mm-hmm. and then had this problem. Tom saw me all mixed together. We didn't know who were the hard before cadre, yeah. But walking around the cell block and talking to him, he pretty well figured out what was going on in a few days. And they were very frank about it.
The prisoners.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I visited a guy who was in solitary confinement, chained to the floor. And I spent a couple hours in the cell with him. You know, what the hell am I doing this for? And he said, it was unpatriotic. I said, what do you mean patriotic? He said, every morning when they line us up, they want us to salute the flag of Vietnam. I'm not a South Vietnamese. I'm a communist. I'm not going to salute the flag of South Vietnam. So here they call that a breach of discipline. Yeah. So they lock me up. They put me in solitary confinement. Every morning they come and say, are you in the salute the flag? I can get out of here anytime I want to. I'll have to say yes. But they can keep me in here the war is over. I'm never going to say yes.
Do you respect them? I sense that
sure.
You felt so respect for the guy.
Yeah. He knew what he was, what he was. He knew what he believed in. And when you looked around and saw he was chained up, they got the messages in, got the messages out, he was well fed. So he had a little social deprivation.
Yeah.
What else did he do? Yeah. Nothing. Was that a big cross for his principles? Everybody in the camp knew about him.
Yeah.
Everybody in the camp knew he was chained up because he was a real communist. And he wouldn't salute the flag. So a very important symbolic thing to the prisoners.
Are you suggesting that prison officials would have done well to just put this guy in and not and just let him circulate so as to remove that symbol for the...
Disregard the fact that he wouldn't salute the flag.
Right, you know, right, that's what
I mean. How were you going to get from it? I mean, this really was a power struggle.
Yeah.
You were going to submit to us, like you'd have with your children.
Yes.
You were going to do what I want because I say so. That's what it was about. Yeah. And the grand effect of the propaganda value... and the lessons that the other cadre who were free were teaching to the other prisoners about, you see how we believe in principle, and you remember those GBN officials who had no principles and ripped off your family and were corrupt. Look what we're like. That was all lost, not understood, not cared about. There's thousands of those guys. So there's that whole aspect to the program, its judicial aspects, its legality. And, you know, we had the Constitution change to make communism a crime under the Constitution.
Yeah.
So that we could sentence them for a violation of the Constitution if we could prove they were a communist.
Yeah.
And it took three independent reports to say they were a communist.
Yeah.
And then that was an automatic crime. Because we had said in the Constitution it was unconstitutional to be a communist.
That's,
you know, Gage worked all the legalities of that, made sure that all the legal things were in place.
How did he feel about doing that?
Well, he thought it was important that what we did was legal.
But isn't that
and so,
kind of,
you know,
putting the horse before
the... They went through the, whatever was the constitutional requirements. I forget whether it was a national referendum or the province, the national legislature, you know, was put before them as a bill to amend the constitution. And I forgot what article it was, Article 4 or Article 6 was inserted in the constitution that was illegal to be communist. Then that gave us the legal basis to proceed. And,
to do what had been being done all along.
Right. But now there were judicial committees formed in each province who were chaired
Security
by the province
committees.
Chief. And
yeah.
They had the administrative judicial right under the law to decide whether someone was a communist or not with no juries and no lawyers.
The Central Security Committee.
This was at the province.
And then, yes, and then
and
there
they
was.
They sentenced them.
Right.
And then this was reviewed by the Central Security Committee, of which the Special Police and the Minister of Interior and people like that were involved. And then the sentence was upheld. They were transported to Gunson Island and sent to school.
Yes, I'm definitely going to be.
And all that was legal. I think it was Desmond Palmer, but I'm not sure, who was the legal guy in Malaysia. And, you know, they made a big point to us in setting up Phoenix. They brought Sir Robert Thompson and several of these other people over, the commissioner of police and the director
Duncan,
of the prison.
Duncan, David Duncan.
David Duncan.
Yep.
Several times to talk to us about the importance of doing things legally and to uphold democratic kinds of things, and despite the nature of what was going on and everything, be able to point to the legality of things. So we incorporated all those things into the program, got the laws changed and things so that this could be done administratively and by review, and that's what the British did.
Yeah.
The British did exactly the same thing in Malaysia.
Yeah.
No difference.
Yeah.
We set it up along that model. And there was a committee of three people who decided whether a person could be re-sentenced for 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years at a time, but it was, I think, no more than three, and then had to be reviewed again. But if the three of them continued to agree forever, the person would stay in jail forever.
Yeah. Administrative detention and three.
And that was all taken from Malaysia.
And Ireland.
Let's see, I know about that. The jungle constabulary was brought from Malaysia. But there was a big flaw in this. In Malaysia, the communists were Chinese.
Yes, it could be distinguished.
Visibly distinguishable from the population.
Mm.
And you could use ethnic prejudice in the villages to help you in isolating the village. When you punished Malays and Indians for something a Chinese had done, you could get a certain number of Malays and Chinese to rally to your side to provide you information to sever this link to the people. You couldn't do that here.
A lot of people have said to me that the Malaya model didn't work.
And this is why. You could not visibly distinguish them.
Yeah.
They had family ties. They were not ethnically different. They were intermingled in the general population. There was no easy way to separate them in a propaganda political way. You had to physically enforce it always. The British didn't have to. The British had to turn the tide psychologically against them. It was a much easier thing since they were Chinese.
What about that? And they also made good use of that high-value reward program in Malaya, where they gave fantastic reward and then resettled people.
But they weren't Chinese who were retconned.
That's right.
Yeah. They were the Malays and the Indians. They said, what the hell is the Chinese story?
Yeah.
And they exploited that very skillfully. And we couldn't do that. I mean, Sir Robert Thompson told me himself on one of his trips, I don't know how to work and solve this problem in Vietnam. I don't understand it. And I'm glad it's you and not me who has to deal with it. Now he's a little snockered like he usually was, but I think that was fundamentally what he thought. He was trying to give us advice. He knew there were very, very important differences. And he didn't know how to deal with it.
It's certainly reassuring to me to know that Thompson at least recognized the difference. I mean, I can't imagine this guy trying to perpetrate a idea that they were the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, he said, here's all my notes from the 12 years I was there, written in hand, give me this big folder like this, said, you know, you're welcome to extract anything you might find useful, but you understand the problem one whole hell of a lot better than I do. I never lived here. I don't understand this culture. I don't understand this people. And if you want me to tell you about something about Malaysia, ask me.
You know,
but I can't directly tell you what are the answers or how to help you with this problem. I don't even understand it. And what I know of it, I don't know how to solve.
So at least he was honest.
I liked him.
I know Colby.
I liked him. He's a very open, engaging person. He spoke frankly and told you what he thought. I can always deal with somebody like that.
So when did you leave Vietnam for good?
April 1974. I came back to the United States to be a graduate student. I swore I'd never work. work on defense again. I'd never have anything to do with U.S. policy. And the faster that I could finish graduate school and qualify myself to get out of the United States, the better.
Mm-hmm. Things didn't work out that way.
Got sucked back into it once more. And so, you know, graduate school for me was a decompression period. Yeah. It was a lark.
Where did you go?
Georgetown. I mean, I only had to work 30 hours a week to get straight A's.
Yeah.
I could have a full-time job simultaneously at 50 hours a week. It looked like I was working my ass off, and I was on vacation. I wasn't working half as hard as I was accustomed to.
Yeah. Are you a good writer? Do you write well?
So to me, it was a breeze. I had a full tuition scholarship from the university.
Mm-hmm.
I had a GI Bill, a part-time job. Living in the land of the big PX.
Well, you've obviously done very well.
My plan was to go to Tehran.
Really?
Well, that was the next big place.
Do you do much traveling, or are you pretty much
centered here in Europe? We have a lot of offices in Germany, Brussels, Vermont, you know, with U.S. forces.
NATO. Just need to do some contracting for them.
Our Boston office has other offices, Korea, Saudi Arabia.
Do you do any work with Titan?
Yeah.
Well, you know a guy named Warren Milberg? Well, I think it, you know, sometimes I think I'm the living expert on Phoenix. Of course, after talking with you, I don't really feel that way anymore.
Talk to a lot of people, you have an objective synthesis that's different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe inaccurate in some respects. You don't have all the facts, but you've probably got more than you've seen the person.
Yeah, I'm quite confident about that. Talk to a lot of province guys, Dixit guys. Talk to people who built the picks and people who ran it through. RD people and rough puff people. And
you know, but there was more to, you know, the Phoenix operation than the true special branch. They were key parts to it, but they weren't the whole program. And how the program was conceived and executed in the different regions varied greatly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in I-Corps, there were hardly any police operations outside the city. Because there wasn't anything outside the cities except DC contested and NBA controlled areas. So it was a massive military thing. And in order for people not to get blamed for not doing what they were supposed to be doing in Phoenix, you know, they had Kit Carson scouts. And they would, you know, have 20 Kit Carson scouts who, you know, belonged to the US divisions. And so they would run a search operation through a village and let the Kit Carson scouts talk to the local inhabitants and call it a Phoenix operation.
Yeah.
So they could tally one.
Yeah, like Evan Parker said to me, he said, a lot of things were done in the name of Phoenix.
Well, that's an example. I mean, there wasn't a single Vietnamese governmental official, military, police, or civilian even there. But it was turned in as a Phoenix operation.
Mm-hmm.
They did nothing to help establish a VC prep, I mean a GDN presence and role. They didn't even think there was anything important about asking the police to come. I just don't.
What about the role of special forces in Phoenix?
You know, SOG.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, SOG people were at the top, familiar with what Phoenix was doing, and knew what the Phoenix objectives were, and if they killed a VCI in the course of their operations, they turned the name and information into us, and we tallied another one.
Okay.
But, you know, in general, the SOG people operated in a different arena, you know, in Laos or in Cambodia, a lot of it was out of country.
But not far, you couldn't say that a VCI guy who's the province chief of Tain Inn, but lives in Cambodia.
I don't know of any operation like that. I mean, theoretically, that was possible to do.
Yeah, this is.
But I don't know of any time in which they ever asked SOG to carry out such an operation.
Yeah. I mean, it's the boundaries were so hard to determine in some places that it becomes somewhat it becomes somewhat symbolic of what's a VCI, what's a detainee.
Some province, had a big dossier on this guy, and they launched an operation of SOG people from the province, and they killed the guy because he was at the military base that they raided. You know, the province would quickly say, hey, we got the dossier on this guy, and we've eliminated him through the SOG operation. Well, in a fundamental way, we didn't care whether Phoenix directed and ran that operation. We cared that they were talking to one another. Yeah. We cared that they were sharing information. We cared that there was a one province chief killed. Yeah. And that we could keep the VCI tally rolling.
So what's your judgment of Phoenix as a whole? And what is the lesson?
I think that the objectives of the Phoenix program are absolutely essential in any effort overseas in a communist contested area. Any indigenous police force or paramilitary or military organization, however they ought to carry it out, ought to be pursuing a program like Phoenix. And certainly any place that the U.S. goes to assist such things, we ought to lend support and impetus to such things. But you got to start it early. You got to deal with all the inherent bureaucratic problems. Unless you want to set up a unilateral force, you could have got the special branch to carry it out alone.
Right.
You could have got the province officer and the crews and the pick people to carry it out on their own. But that isn't what we tried to do. What we tried to do is say everybody who deals in intelligence, and that meant one whole hell of a lot of people in Vietnam, ought to be coordinated.
Yeah.
We ought to know who each other's agents are. We ought to get each other's sources of information. Well, the only thing they put in there, was dead information that was old that they weren't going to take any action on. That's the way the U.S. intelligence community operates today, in my opinion, right here in Washington.
Same thing, huh?
Same thing.
Anything that's good.
Yeah, we got all kinds of community online databases and computer systems and things. And anything that would give you some real ability to pull off a coup and accomplish something would be known to the president, you'd never put in there.
Yeah, it's like Ollie North and the secret team. One person, Ollie North, becomes the focus as if he alone was responsible for every covert action that goes on everywhere or something.
So, those are, endemic problems with bureaucracies and governmental operations. And they're an order of magnitude worse in underdeveloped countries than they are here. We can't solve them here. Why would we think we can solve them there? But you need to run some kind of effective operation of this type. Mm-hmm. And my own personal view at this point in life is it's best to be done unilaterally. You have to decide in each individual country whether the police were powerful enough, or the military was powerful enough, or how you were going to get it done. But to have an operation that's directed against the civilian members of the Communist Party is crucial and ought to be central in any thing that you're going to do in terms of force in the country. And it ought to be done early.
Do you believe that communism is a crime, that communists are criminals?
No. I mean, communists are nationalists in most of these countries.
Mm-hmm. In other words, you believe it is...
To most of these countries, and undeveloped countries, I believe that what communism is a vehicle of personal power of somebody who's a nationalist.
Okay.
I don't want it to be dominated by foreigners. I don't want foreigners to interfere and directly manipulate the internal workings of my country. I think I would prefer that the person who says it and believes it believes in democracy, not in communism. Because I think communism is a manipulative, destructive, coercive thing. And I don't believe in that. I believe that the standard of living and the well-being of the people is best served by a democratic process of government. And I think that that's what the bottom line is. The bottom line is to improve human condition. And communist governments don't do that. So I'm opposed to that basis alone. But nonetheless, the person who is a nationalist and sincerely believes in communism, in my book, is better than the toady who is personally enriching himself through cooperation with foreigners who are trying to muck around in this country. And the failure of most U.S. policy in most areas of the world is we seem to lack an ability to find and promote and support the democratic nationalists among the population, mm-hmm. as opposed to those who want to use us for something in an obscene way against their own people. I would put people like Marcos, yep. Shaw, and people like that in that category. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have, sure, they have supported U.S. interests in many important ways in our national security needs on a global basis, but they have done next to nothing for their own people. And in fact, they have impoverished their own people in many different ways, through oppression of the press, through economic control, through personal enrichment, you know, in some gross, obscene way. I would rather have a communist than that. But I believe in every country there are nationalists who are democratically inclined. And so the trick is to find them and support them in ways that are not intrusive and don't turn them into the corrupt people that aren't the people that you want to support. And I think a part and parcel of how you go about doing that has to be encourage operations against the Communist Party. I mean, you can't let communists operate freely using terrorist methods against the Democrats.
Because the Democrats are ultimately the target of the communists. It's those people mm-hmm. who are the strong.
Not so, strong. You know, I don't believe, although I would listen to an eye along the lines, I don't believe that in order to preserve democratic freedoms, you have to eschew mm-hmm. operations like these. I think they can be a part of your kit bag. That you bring to bear on the problem. But it has to be done in a sensitive kind of way. So, I think there are substantive moral, I don't believe, in an idealistic way, I don't think they're impossible to conduct to the ends that I just said. In a pragmatic way, some days I have my doubts in some countries. And, you know, you might want to make an assessment in some individual country that, you know, there isn't any force that you can rely on to carry out these kinds of operations without abusing it. Therefore, you're better off to not have it mm-hmm. than to have it abused and have it become something communists point to as a reason why you should support them instead of the democratic government.
Right.
And that's a possibility in some places.
Can I ask you just one last question? Wait, did you get involved in that Phoenix reevaluation like that was done with Craig Johnston and Martin Christie?
I've never been involved in Phoenix in my life.
I got that on tape.
I do have an important request. I'm concerned about
how some of this might come out. And what it is you're going to write and what it is you're going to say. Both of some things that I feel are important for context, but are not things that I believe ought to be important in your book. And I would like you to not use them.
Specifically?
They're not things about the program, they're things about me.
Okay, that's fine.
There are some things there, and probably some things that you've heard from other things that are part of what I regard as my personal life, or to have to do with the way I went about getting the information and doing the things that I did that I don't think serve any useful purpose to be published in the United States.
Well, unless it was something that you mentioned now, I don't know what you're talking about. I haven't heard anything about your methods or what you might be alluding to. I mean, unless you've said something specifically to me.
Well, I mean, if you want to say that I killed 10 people out here on a funeral, stuff like that. You want to say that...
I know.
I'm just saying, yeah. It's not that kind of stuff.